I'm also going to turn on my tape so I can eventually upload these to the internet. So the optimistic approach to life generally leads to a sense of disappointment and to a sense of, well, what went wrong. It doesn't always seem to be the most realistic approach. But then, of course, even more detrimental is the needlessly worrying, pessimistic outlook on life. And it's variation of the life based on avoidance of all things that cause any form of anxiety or fear. There's actually an interesting clinical paper that came out about 9 years ago, a very famous paper. See if I've written it down in my notes. It was called Bad is Stronger Than Good. And it sort of was an attempt to answer the question, what is the inherent nature of the mind? And what these psychologists presented was basically a lot of clinical studies that showed that people tend to remember the bad and forget much quicker the neutral or good experiences. We tend to be people that, humans are people that tend to, well, worry about and cling to bad outcomes. One clinical study showed that in couples, for every critical remark you make, it takes 5 uncritical remarks to undo the memory of the critical remark. Try putting that into practice, by the way. But it's true. And it's said with kids, with children, that it's even more than that. That it's something like you require 10 positive, reaffirming attaboys for each "you should have done this better," "you could have been, you know, a doctor," "what's the matter with you," you know, "why aren't you doing better in school" type of mark. So the mind tends to seize on the bad news and carry it around. Another study showed that they showed photographs of people frowning, people with neutral expressions, and people with positive expressions. And the faces that people could recall were invariably the negative expressions. We carry around bad memories, and we also carry around, we hyper-focus on criticism, on expressions that look unwelcoming. Of course, one of the problems with pessimism, looking at the dark side of life, always expecting the worst outcome, is that, first of all, so much of what we worry about doesn't actually occur. It's generally a waste of time. And very often, when bad things do occur, they're not the bad things that we expect. And very often, when bad things do occur, we tend to actually perform pretty well when they do occur. We tend to actually perform, in fact, studies have shown, better when bad things occur out of the blue than when we perform when we are prepared. Because believe it or not, when we are often prepared, we go into situations stressed out, anxious, defensive, and therefore we don't actually perform with any sense of fluidity or openness or awareness. We've boxed ourselves off into a corner. So, needless pessimism, just like continuous optimism, can be not only a poor approach to living, but certainly ones that can cause a lot of needless suffering. Now, a variation of pessimism and fear is perhaps the worst outcome, which is a life based on avoidance. Avoidance is generally a psychological term for when we have an experience that is negative, and then we try to avoid that experience occurring again by avoiding anything that even remotely reminds us of it. A good example of that is people with obsessive compulsive disorder who at first might have a fear of touching a public faucet. So they carry around handy wipes and they wipe down every faucet. And then generally that fear or avoidance spreads to door handles, and then to the handles, of course, on toilet seats, and then to touching anything public. And then eventually, rather than this technique of wiping everything down repeatedly working, eventually people with OCD find it very difficult to even go outside and interact. Some of the extreme forms of OCD, not the run-of-the-mill kind, but there are severe forms of OCD where this kind of avoidance can spread into all of the interactions and the public moving about in the course of the day. Other examples of just avoidance are, of course, people going into a relationship, and the relationship breaks up, and they decide, well, relationships are not for me. Or somebody who has a dog, and they love the dog very much, and the dog, of course, eventually dies, and then out of a sense of great loss and not wanting to experience those painful emotions again, people often decide never again to have an animal in their lives. So rather than getting the opportunity to enjoy life again with these experiences, simply because of one component, we tend to avoid the entire process altogether. We don't have a dog because we don't like the feelings of when the dog dies. We don't get into relationships, perhaps, because we don't like the feeling of being broken up with. Some people, when they're in relationships, my favorite, I've talked to people who have the premature breakup mode to save themselves from being broken up with. So they go for the first happy 2 months and then find a reason to break up, generally unconsciously, but sometimes it's even overtly consciously, because they don't want to have to go through somebody saying, well, you know, it's not you, it's me, blah, blah, blah. So they think, well, it's much less painful for me to break up with them, so I'll just make sure that I get there first, etc. We all have the things in life that we want to avoid at all costs. The problem, again, with avoidance is that it doesn't work. Cognitive behavioral therapists will show you people with fear of heights, when they try to avoid heights like going on top of mountains or the edges of buildings, eventually more and more and more things trigger that fear. When we avoid something to avoid the fear, more and more and more things become associated, and we start avoiding more and more. People who have agoraphobia, who fear going out, eventually generally just started with a fear of often simply public speaking, and it spread to the point where they literally can't go outdoors. The fear of one specific type of event that they avoided, because they avoided it, eventually that avoidance tendency grows and grows and grows until they're trapped indoors. So the approach to life based on avoidance or fear or pessimism, or on the other hand, complete optimism, are all outlooks that cause us suffering. So the Buddha came up with two teachings which I love, and they give us a very straightforward approach to how to navigate through life that I think is much more successful, and I'm going to tell you what they are. The first teaching that I love of the two is the Kalamas, where basically a group of people that the Buddha had come to talk to said, well, why should we believe a word that you say? There's people coming through this area all the time, and they're teaching us stuff. And then the next teacher will come through, and he'll say, nah, don't believe what that guy said. Believe what I said. And then a third teacher will pass through, and he'll say, don't believe what the first two teachers said. Believe what the third said. And the Buddha responded, don't believe a word that I say. Don't believe what anybody says. Don't believe what your reasoning or what common sense or what the wisdom of the day is. What you should believe is what you see for yourself to be true. And then the Buddha went on in that sutta to simply say the foundations of this practice are simply seeing that our own happiness and our own suffering are largely caused by our own actions and our own thoughts. That rather than being caused by other people or by events around us, the majority of our suffering are the results of our own actions. And from that, we can start focusing on what our actions are and start preventing a lot of our suffering. Now the second teaching, and this is the teaching I'm going to be really focusing on, is the one of the sutta where he taught his son, Rahula. And he basically gave Rahula a bunch of lessons for how to live your life. And it boils down to the following. When you're about to do something or when you're doing something, see if it's causing suffering. If it's causing suffering, stop. If it's not causing suffering, you can keep doing what you're doing and see if it brings long-term happiness or long-term peace of mind. If you find that something that you've done has caused yourself or someone else suffering, after you've done it, find somebody who you respect, share about it, and resolve to not do it again. But by all means, keep living. Keep experimenting with life. Don't avoid life. Don't run away from it. Simply see what you've done specifically that caused the mistake and avoid that specific action, not the entire endeavor. Notice that the Buddha in this teaching never says to his son, by the way, if you make a mistake, fuck you, you little asshole, you little piece of shit. What's the matter with you? You're my son. You're supposed to be perfect. There was a great study where a bunch of psychologists at, I think, Columbia, I'm not sure, I'll have to look this one up again, but they did this study where they broke up children in, I think they were seventh grade, into children that were reinforced by their parents for their efforts, how much effort they put in, and then a second group of children that were reinforced for their results, whether they got good grades or not. So the first group, they got rewarded with allowances or whatever if they put a lot of effort in, regardless of their results. The second group were children that were rewarded based on their results. Now, the first group, the children that were rewarded for their efforts, wound up being largely extremely successful, happy people that found careers that they enjoy, were kids that when they were given challenges that they didn't immediately know how to solve, looked forward to it, rolled up their sleeves and got down to work and really expended energy, knowing that they would be rewarded both externally from their parents and internally as well for the effort that they put in. On the other hand, the kids that were rewarded for their grades and not their efforts tended, in fact, to fail downwards, tended, in fact, to, when they got challenges that they didn't know the immediate answer, tended to blame their teachers, tended to cheat more often, tended to be more unhappy at school. So the idea is to not focus always on our mistakes as so much as the fact that we've had mistakes, or turn it into a story about ourselves, to label ourselves as losers, or how could I be so stupid, but instead to focus on our efforts. So what should these efforts be? The first is, again, if you make a mistake in life, notice what the action was that caused it. Don't turn it into a story about yourself. Once you figure out what the action was, try again at it, doing a different action. Resolve not to repeat the action that caused the mistake. And try to hang around with people that you respect, that seem to know what they're doing. I'll give you an example. At the extreme age of 45, I decided to learn how to skateboard. Because I wanted to. I live in Williamsburg. Do I need another explanation? If you don't know how to skateboard in Williamsburg, you are run out by the... No, you're not. I have enough tattoos that I'm allowed to stay in, but just barely. I have my passport, but they're thinking of revoking it unless I learn to skateboard. So I got my skateboard, and I jumped on it, and I resolved that I was going to learn skateboarding the way the Buddha taught us to live. And so I'm going to call this teaching skateboarding and, what was it, motorcycle and the... Zen and the Art of Motorcycle. So, Buddhism and the Art of Skateboarding. That is tonight's talk. Buddhism and the Art of Skateboarding. So the first thing was, I would get on the board and kick along, and the first thing I had to learn was how to get off without breaking my neck. I know some people who just jump on things and without figuring out how to stop, they just go right ahead. If I had done that, I would not be sitting here in front of you right now. Believe me. So I actually first took it slowly, saw how to get off the skateboard when I was losing my balance, how to jump off, so that I didn't have to fall every time. When you fall and you're 45, believe me, it fucking hurts. Just take my word for it. It's not like when you're 25 and you're drunk all the time, like I was when I was 25, and you don't feel a thing. You could probably fall off a building and not feel a thing. I've actually known people who've fallen off a building while they're drunk and nothing happens to them. They get sober, they fall from 3 rungs up on a ladder and break their fucking legs. That's one of the gifts of sobriety. But anyway, I don't know where I got to that. That's just pre-association. Anyway, So skateboarding, yeah. So first thing I learned was how to get off the damn thing. Then when I would fall, I wouldn't stay away from it. I'd figure out what I did, whether I leaned too far, kicked too hard, was I pushed too far in front of the deck. What did I do right before I fell? And then I would resolve not to do it again, and then I'd get back on the damn skateboard, no matter how much my brain wanted to say, well, that's it for the day. You've fallen, you're in pain. Any normal human being would call it a day. But that's what my brain says. But then, again, my brain is the kind of thing that first thing in the morning, it's waiting for me with a bunch of insults. So, you know, I'm not going to listen to that. Literally, the first thing I look in the mirror and my brain was, my God, we're bald today, aren't we? That's what I have for a brain. So so I've had to do a lot of work with this Buddhism stuff. So, get back on it. Don't stay away. Don't avoid the things that cause us a little bit of suffering or pain. Figure out what we did wrong and try it again, but this time not doing the specific action that caused the suffering. Now, this is such a radically different way that most people live, right? I read this study where people who, if they have one bad action, interaction on the internet, will tend to avoid the internet for a year afterwards or something insane like that. We all have this thing where if something goes wrong, we just want to avoid the entire domain altogether, rather than looking specifically at what reversible or avoidable action, specific action, we could undo and replace with a new action and continue learning. Finally, the Buddha said with his son, to find someone who you respect or you see as a wise spiritual practitioner, and to acknowledge when you cause suffering for other people. Again, you don't have to turn it into a whole story about what a shit you are, because the more we insult ourselves, the more stressed out we become, the more defensive we become, the more delusional, and the less clear seeing. Beating up on ourselves in no way, shape, or form helps us discover our mistakes and undo them. We don't have to confuse our actions with who we are. Our actions, of course, will cause in the future a lot of our happiness and our suffering, but that it doesn't define us. It doesn't define who we are. They are simply our actions. So if we make a mistake in our lives, that doesn't mean we are losers or no good, or it doesn't mean we're anything. It simply means that action we should avoid in the future. Okay? So part of the process of finding a spiritual person that we respect or somebody that we think is wise is having somebody that we can simply share with in case we don't know what it is we did wrong. Sometimes in life, we just can't figure it out. We say, wow, I got on that skateboard, and I was standing right there, and I pushed as hard as I possibly could, and I went flying off. What the hell did I do wrong? And then if you're like me, you have like a bunch of guys who are standing around, and they go, well, you pushed as hard as you fucking could. That's not a good idea, because you don't have your balance yet. Just push a little lighter or whatever. Stand a little bit more forward on the board, turn yourself a little bit to the side, whatever. They know what they're doing. That's why you seek them out. And so, in life, if we have issues with relationships, we might want to find somebody who's been in a relationship, who's in a good relationship, that has good communication, and talk with them and see what it is they've done. If we have issues with drinking, we might want to find somebody who's sober and who's worked with those issues. If we've had issues with our taxes and we don't know how to do them, we might want to find an accountant. I'm not an accountant. That's not a pitch for anything. I just threw that in there. So anyway, those are basically the Buddha's approaches to that he taught his 7-year-old son. And I have to say, even though they sound really simple and they sound really obvious, so many of us don't practice them. So many of us would rather avoid or simply sit around worrying about imaginary bad things that could happen that probably won't happen. So many of us would rather simply hope for the best and simply jump back in without trying to learn from mistakes that or actions that we've taken that are mistaken. I think this approach of taking a moment to review, not turning into a story about self, just itemizing our actions, seeing which work, which don't work, taking that kind of an inventory, and then putting them into practice are some of the more successful tools that I've ever encountered for living. So that's tonight's talk. If you're interested, the suttas were the Rahula and the Kalama suttas. You can look them up online at Access to Insight. And now it's your turn to talk about anything that's going on in your life or any questions or things about what I've talked about.
Yeah, I was just about my age, and I found myself thinking a lot about it, and the same thoughts over and over again, and I've been kind of trying to do some of the techniques that you talked about as far as, you know, with the mental part of it, but I was wondering if you have any more ideas about when there's a lot of grief involved, as far as, I feel like I've been talking to you about it for a while, but it's still kind of lingering, and I'm going to be away for about a month, and I'm going to have more limited access to the phone, and I've been talking to you a lot about it, and that's been helping me feel better, but I just wondered if you have any more suggestions.
Yeah, I mean, again, one of the things we try to do is try to strip away the storytelling and just feel the feelings, because the feelings are real, but the stories don't really accomplish very much. When we experience a lot of grief, a loss, a disruption in life, we try to, what we call, process it by coming with a little statement, a way we can say we've come to terms with it. Generally, this little statement, these little sentences, these little thoughts that we attach to life, they, rather than bringing any clarity, they actually tend to just, we tend to use them to replace feeling the feelings. So one of the things that I do is when something like that happens, especially having lost both my parents in the last year, what I did was simply, instead of turning it into a story, I simply sat down, you know, found a quiet place and said, okay, now my father is dead. Just that simple saying. Not adding anything more. And just asking myself how that felt. How does it feel my dad is dead? That's it. Right? Now, the problem is most people don't stop there and they tend to add a lot of self into it, instead of just simply saying, my father is dead, or my friend is dead, or I've broken up with my husband, my wife, or whatever. We tend to then add a story. I'll never see them again. I won't have as many friends. I. What will I do when it's blah, blah, blah? And that's all story. That's not the feelings. The feelings are what arises just with the very bare fact. My friend is dead. How do I feel about that? What's there? What's not there? You know? Those are the feelings. And if you can sit and really experience those feelings arising and passing, eventually, we manage to experience life from a much more realistic level. I think that the final greatest gifts that my parents gave me was that they showed me that I'm going to die. Because I saw all these pictures of them after they died, that where they look in these photos exactly like me. You know, they're my age in the photos. They're just as much in life. They're just as much animated and talking. And yet, they die, right? And so, we all of us, even people who practice every day like I do and study the Dharma, there's still this lingering, well, I don't have to think about it, you know, or, you know, it's not so, you know, there's sort of still this underlying experiential denial. Where even though we might intellectually know it's true, we still have this sort of level of denial.
When I think about that, then the next thing I think is somebody was really young, you know? And it's like, I mean, I know that happens to everybody, but it's just then it becomes a philosophical thing of like, why, you know? And then that's where I start
thinking about it. The philosophical part, beyond the fact that that's just what happens, is really not going to bring you any clarity. Because basically, I mean, the sum total of what the Buddha said is that we all die, right? We all grow old. We all get sick. We die. And he said, furthermore, that there's no guarantee of how long we get to live. a lot of his teachings were to the families of people who died very young. And, I mean, in terms of a lesson to derive from that, the single lesson is, yes, death, the possibility of death being always present, I shouldn't put off my happiness or the happiness of the people who love me around me. Because putting that off for even a day could be a day too long, I put it off. That's the only lesson. Right? Thank you. Hi.
First, I want to thank everyone and everyone who's been a sharing for her sharing, and thanks for everyone's energy today. I had a question about avoidance when it comes to addictions. I just had a I don't really know how to frame the question exactly, but I'm just getting out of a huge addiction part of my life. And it's funny how when you become sober, shit hurts a lot more.
Yeah.
Very true. But how do you know, like someone who smokes cigarettes.
Right.
Like, what if they just enjoy it? I don't really get this, what you're saying about that. Avoid it. Like, let's say I wanted to avoid that.
Right.
I don't know how to phrase it.
I think I can phrase your question. Yeah. At what point, for instance, with drinking, there are alcoholics. Any a single drink can cause an alcoholic to spiral into complete lack of control, complete oblivion. On the other hand, there are people who are just hard drinkers who might have to learn not to, you know, have five shots of tequila in a row, but aren't alcoholics, right? In my experience, the alcoholic pretty much invariably, alcohol has a detrimental effect, and eventually, most alcoholics really, 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 really try to figure it out in a way to make it work, and eventually, no matter how they, in fact, if anybody doesn't try to avoid, it's alcoholics, right? I mean, with alcohol, they try to figure it out. They're like, oh yeah, it was the tequila, not the scotch. If I just drink the scotch, oh, well, if I only drank this specific brand of scotch, then I could have made it work. Eventually, if an entire line of endeavor is clearly poisonous, you will know. Because whenever you do it, it's going to have dire results in your life. Right? Alcoholics don't have, you know, I mean, sure, they can have occasional nights where they don't do something crazy, but by and large, alcohol has a very detrimental effect in their life. On the other hand, with things that we don't have to avoid completely, they don't have entirely detrimental effects in our life, long-term suffering. With alcoholics, the suffering in the long term is undeniable. Your life gets worse if you drink, if there's drinking in it. On the other hand, with somebody who's not an alcoholic, their life doesn't get worse in the long term simply because they drink occasionally. Sometimes they might even tie one on, but their life doesn't get worse in the long term. That's really the final. The Buddha said the difference between a wise man and a fool is that a wise man sees the long-term results of actions and the fool doesn't. So if you notice that some endeavor is causing you long-term suffering, then you pretty much have a case to say, well, okay. But first of all, before you jump to that conclusion, in most of the endeavors, people tend to, with things that they are not addicted to, they tend to avoid unnecessarily. They'll get up on skis, fall the first time, and then never get up on skis ever again, because skis are bad, you know? No, you might want to take a lesson. People, you know, get into relationships, they go through a breakup, and then they want to avoid all relationships after it. You get the idea. Relationships don't cause long-term suffering. Skis don't cause long-term suffering. But I guarantee you, if you're an alcoholic or drug addict, they will cause long-term suffering for you, and you will see it. Or hopefully you will.
Yeah, well, I was more curious, you know, like, I think cigarettes are a good example of someone that can function every day and be addicted to a substance. I don't understand how that you can do that in practice. It's
how you can smoke and be, and
you don't get that.
A lot of Zen masters, there's videos of them smoking away like crazy. Actually, in the Theravada, you're not really supposed. If there's in the Theravada rules, there's for monks, you're not supposed to smoke. But I've seen some famous Zensters smoking away. So
I'm just curious to understand how that can coexist.
Smoking and Buddhism.
Yeah. I just don't understand how that works.
Well, I would say in the long term it would cause you suffering, and I would say that it would be best if. But then again, remember, all of the teachings in Buddhism are goals, they're not absolutes. They're things that we're working towards. The Buddha never said, if you lie, well, that's it. Fuck you. You can't be. You know, he said the precepts are to avoid killing, stealing, lying, causing harm through sex or intoxication. The idea being that these are the things we aim for. But if we make a mistake in life, then we try to learn from them and head in those directions. So if you are addicted to cigarettes and you realize that they're causing you harm, you know, if you don't, you're probably in a state of somewhat a state of denial. But, you know, eventually try to aim yourself in the direction of quitting. But I would never make a globalizing statement like somebody who smokes cigarettes and, you know, they shouldn't practice Buddhism.
Well, of course not.
Yeah.
But would it be a goal for most people to try to stop that?
Probably.
Unless you just
talk about it. Well, I mean, there's some people that I would say they shouldn't try to stop immediately. For instance, somebody who's just out of, you know, I've read that, you know, when people go to mental institutions, it's the one, they should not try to stop smoking because it actually works as it calms your moods, and it actually acts as a mood inhibitor, so a mood stabilizer. So by all means, if you're fresh out of a institution tonight, I encourage you to smoke. Just realizing the profound things I'm saying tonight. Yes, you shouldn't be in here. You should be outside smoking, for the love of God. What are you doing here? But most people, yeah, it would probably be a good idea if they eventually aim towards stopping smoking.
Just one last thing.
Sure.
I remember last week you were saying something about you should do what makes you feel good.
No. No, I didn't say that. even mostly if it's close, I'll say, yeah, I said something like that, but no, I didn't say that one. I said that if it causes long-term peace of mind for you and other people, that's a good idea, but not if it feels, because especially feels would be an indicator of sensual pleasures.
Yeah.
So that's no. Yeah.
Yeah.
Good. I'm glad, because I know I'm going to read the paper, you know, or something, you know.
Yeah.
Buddhist says, just do what feels good. then Noah will call me up and he'll be like, what the fuck? Do what feels good. Yeah, that's what it boils down to. No, it's really what we're aiming for is to end suffering by focusing on what actions that we're doing that cause our suffering and the suffering of people around us. And simply, rather than beat ourselves up, to simply resolve not to do those actions and to do the actions that bring long-term, not short-term, but long-term happiness. If you're a crack addict, crack will bring you short-term peace of mind. It will. The problem is that the amount of effort you have to put in to get crack, as opposed to the long-term peace of mind it brings, it's not a good payoff. But meditation, 20 minutes, brings you a long-term peace of mind. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, you first, then you. Hi.
I was going to ask about I'm having a hard time drawing a line between avoidance and being attached to something. I think you use the puppy as an example, right? Probably what I've been going through lately is I don't want to catch myself being attached to something, like maybe people or relationships in particular. So I like to do the typical guy thing and bail out, right?
Mm-hmm.
But and you were talking tonight, I totally is what it is. I just want to avoid the words, if it's too serious and that you have to break it up and I have to go turmoil, I can't deal with it. But at the same time, I don't want to let myself get dependent on someone or something. Does that make sense at all? Kind of get what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, it means that you're a guy, first of all.
Yeah.
No, I mean, really what it means is, first of all, if we fear commitment, the best thing to do is, rather than avoiding it, to practice it in as slow and as safe a way as we can. For instance, when cognitive behavioral therapists take people with fear of heights, deal with people with fear of heights, they don't say avoid all heights. That's the one thing they would never do. They say, okay, let's take you up in an elevator to the top floor. We'll just stand there. We won't get out of the elevator. The next day we'll take a step out. The day after that we'll take two steps out and then go back in the elevator. Slowly, you're integrating yourself into something that you're avoiding. But you're doing it very slowly and securely and step by step, so that with each step you can see where you're causing, what thoughts you're causing yourself stress, what unnecessary thoughts you're thinking during it. Most of the time if somebody is on the top of a building and they're scared, they think maybe a gust of wind will blow me off, or what happens if I have an uncontrollable urge to leap off or whatever. So you tend to divert them from those thoughts while they're up top. So a lot of times when people are afraid of or avoid commitments, it's because of all the thoughts they have of what might happen. So rather than carry all those thoughts into a committed situation, we say instead of worrying about what might happen, focus on what is actually happening and see what is causing the stress that you can avoid, you can change, what actions you can undo or do differently.
Yeah, it makes sense. It's like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, in terms of just delineating between.
But even in terms of friendships, sometimes friendships, I'm noticing that I don't want, a lot of times around me there's a lot of misery, a lot of people are unhappy.
Right.
And as a friend, I want to be compassionate, right? There's a certain point where it makes me sick, because pretty soon I feel I want to, be a pal and start bitching with them. Next thing you know, I'm complaining, I made myself miserable, 2 weeks later. So, but how do you do that without bailing? You know what I mean?
Part of the thing is being able to, a lot of people avoid entire friendships rather than having difficult conversations. Avoiding difficult conversations probably causes more suffering than any other tendency we pick up in life. I mean, literally, people will bail on families, bail on relationships, bail on jobs, bail on simply to avoid having a difficult conversation. And so, again, the trick is to practice ways of communicating that do not cause as much suffering as the previous communications that made you so wanting to avoid those difficult communications. Most of the time we avoid because at some point in our past we've had a communication where it's wound up in yelling or people being very hurt or people being extremely emotional. And one of the ways to avoid that is to practice taking turns sharing, repeating what the person said to you, put into practice all of the tools that can make a conversation go well so that it won't spiral into something that's out of control. Learn not to interrupt. learn not to try to figure what the other person is, you know, saying. Ask them to clarify what they're saying rather than assume, you know, when you're not. Yeah. So, I mean, generally practicing different approaches to communication rather than avoiding difficult conversations is an extremely healthy approach. Finally, you asked what to delineate between, on the one hand, avoidance, and on the other hand, clinging or attaching. And in my experience, there's actually a discernible gulf between the two. I mean, between, you know, we tend to think, wow, if I get into that relationship, the next thing I know, they'll be dependent, and I'll have responsibilities, and I'll have to do things I don't like all the time. But generally, that's a projection into the future based on maybe one experience in the past. What we should do instead is, again, bring our focus to what's actually happening on a day-by-day basis. If there's something that where we feel that we're being somebody's being over-demanding or overly needy or whatever, call them on that specific event rather than throw up our hands and simply say, that's it. You know, fuck relationship, fuck this, I'm just running away. Thank you. Hey.
Hey. I was just thinking that it seems sometimes really hard to distinguish between situations where your suffering in the moment is going to pay off down the line, and like moving to a new city or you start college or whatever it's involved with. You keep second guessing yourself, maybe this is the thing for me, or, you know, that kind of situation. I'm just wondering, are there certain hallmarks of the kinds of pain or suffering that one would be in when you know there's some kernel of you that knows that it might yield something down the line versus the kind of doubt that we get into where it's just an endless loop? I mean, I don't know if that makes sense. Like, there's something where you say, you know, maybe I don't want to live in New York or whatever, you know, your first month in New York, which I'm sure everybody has. But, you know, then maybe that would be the place that would be wonderful for you, or, you know, and like the, there's some growing pains involved always.
Yeah, as I understand the question, there are some endeavors in life that are just painful and they're not going to pay off in the long term versus some endeavors where to get what we need, we have to sit through a certain amount of discomfort. And how do we determine when we're in something that's just not going to pay off, you know, versus something where we should sit through the pain to get to the long-term good result? I mean, that's an extremely important question. It's I've actually asked that to some of the monks that I've studied with, and basically what I've heard them say is that you focus on, over a period of time, the amount of effort that goes in versus the amount of payoff that you're seeing in your life. Now, obviously, there are certain things where the payoff is going to be very much in the long term, and that's where sometimes a little bit of faith is required. For example, if you're going to graduate school, it's really painful in the first year, and you know, you really, really, really want to bail because being a psychologist just isn't worth it because all these classes, all the money, all the time missed with my friends and all that. And you're just going to have to take it as a little bit of faith that 6 years from now, 4 years from now, you're going to be very happy with the effort that you put in. That's the only time. Now, with most of our endeavors in life, it's a much shorter time span, where if it's like you move to a new city, and at first you're not going to know anybody, you're not going to feel comfortable, you're not going to know your way around, people are going to be, you know, strange, you're not going to know where food is, you're not blah, 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 blah. So over a period of time, you can see, like, what's the amount of effort you're having to put in to feel acquainted with the place, to meet people, to feel accepted, to feel comfortable, and what the results of those efforts are. If it's really the wrong place for you, over a period of a couple of months, you should be able to see very clearly, well, I'm putting in all this effort, and I'm just not getting I know two people who moved to Seattle at the exact same time. One person loves it, doesn't ever want to leave. The other person can't stand it. There's nothing wrong with Seattle, right? It's just that one person really, you know, doesn't feel at home, and no matter what they've tried, they're not getting the results they want in the long term out of it. So the most important thing is to keep our eyes open, to see the amount of effort we're expending and what kind of results we're getting, and to give it the trial a decent amount of time, to try different efforts, you know, if we're only going to one neighborhood instead of another, to see what actions we could do to maybe alleviate it. But eventually, if no matter what we try, no matter how much effort we put into it, we're not getting any of the results, then I think it'll be pretty clear. I can't give you, though, a 2 weeks. I wish I could.
No, thank you.
Thank you. Hey, how's it going?
Good. My first attempt at meditation. That's interesting.
Oh, good.
Question, you were talking about earlier, the type of person that stresses and their mind is occupied with worrying, and it often leads to avoidance. What about the scenario where one actually does engage in a healthy way, say a huge project or some complicated endeavor, going at it, but their mind is still occupied by worrying? You know, just, for example, you know, I would think about that project all the time, either actively trying to figure stuff out in my head, or I'm just thinking about it in a passive way, but my thoughts are about that project. Do you have any thoughts or tools for dealing with that kind of non-productive worrying, thinking about it?
Yeah, I mean, there are, and I've given this talk a couple of times, but the Buddha did list 5 ways of getting rid of obsessive thoughts. That, you know, I'll give you some of them. The first is to replace obsessive thoughts with thoughts that, you know, don't try to stop thinking. Instead, try to think thoughts that are useful. Replace unskillful thoughts with skillful thoughts. For example, if you're worrying about something, instead focus on the things that have gone well with the project so far. Develop a sense of pride in so far what the elements that have gone well, so that you can repeat those actions and focus on doing those again. There's a study that shows that the people worry more the more they're in situations where they have no power, where they feel powerless. People worry over things over which we have no control. So if you focus on the areas that you do have control, focus your mind on those areas, you'll probably worry less. So instead of worrying about what globally could go wrong, you know, what bad things could occur, focus on what actions you have to take next, and because that's something you do have control over, and try to work those actions out. That's an example of replacing one type of thought with another type of thought. The second thing the Buddha said is find the part of your body that gets stressed out when you think that way, and breathe into it and relax it. For every time we get stressed out, there's some part of your body that's going to be tight, that's going to get contracted. This is not just the Buddha. Actually, a lot of good neuroscientists like Antonio Damasio have taught the same thing, shown the same thing, that when we get stressed out, we release cortisol and various peptides. And when we do, we get tense physically. And if you relax that part of the body by breathing into it, you'll worry less. So that's another approach. The third approach, the Buddha said, is to reflect on what it would be like if we thought this way all the time. If thinking away all the time makes you think, oh my God, I'd lose my mind if I thought this way all the time, it's probably an indication that it's not a good way to think. A good way to think is something that you could think most of the time and wouldn't cause you, you know, suffering. Another way, another test that I use is the externalize it test. Imagine if somebody was saying those thoughts to you. would you allow them to follow you around and say those thoughts to you? Would you allow somebody to say, you know, that thing we're working on, it really is not going to work out. It's really terrible. It's going to be just an awful outcome. I don't know why we did it. You know, this is a total waste of time. I can't believe I work at this place. It's just. Would you allow that person to do that, right? No, you basically tell them to fuck off pretty quickly. But because it's in our mind, we think we're obligated to think these thoughts, but we're not. All of our thoughts originated from outside. There are things we've heard that we've internalized. We don't just come up with these thoughts out of the blue. The mind basically is a regurgitator. It hears things and it repeats it. Now, somewhere in your past, you probably have been exposed to people who've worried. And you've internalized that worry. So you're not obligated to repeat that process in your mind simply because you've heard other people in your life do it. You can say, okay, if somebody else said these thoughts to me, would I accept them or not? If you wouldn't accept them, just say, okay, you know what? I see that these are not worthy thoughts of my time. I acknowledge that they're there. I know that they feel that they're there to protect me. You know, that's why we have these thoughts, because they think they're going to protect us in case bad things happen. But just remind ourselves that we can actually survive thinking in a healthier way that brings us more long-term happiness. Most of the times that bad things happen anyway, again, we're much more likely to succeed unprepared than if we over-worry things out. Because when we do, we tend to actually get ourselves stressed out. We tend to limit our options. We tend to not act fluidly. We tend to not act in a spontaneous way. We tend to act in a way that's very disjointed and bent out of shape. So you're better off anyway not worrying. Does any of that make a... Cool. All right, so I think that we've heard enough of my blathering for tonight. I've blathered myself out. So just one brief, just find your seat again. Close your eyes just for a moment. We're just going to end with a very brief mana meditation, then we'll be done. I thank you all for coming to Dharmapunk. And the bowl there is just for you to help pay the rent if you'd like. If you don't have money, don't worry about it. So closing the eyes, letting go of everything you've heard tonight, if it's important, it will stay with you, bringing your awareness within, relaxing the shoulders again, relaxing the belly, and just repeating the following thoughts, reflecting on the wisdom that true peace of mind and happiness comes from within. So there's nothing selfish about wishing ourselves happiness, nor is there anything risky about wishing other beings happiness, as their true happiness comes from within. It doesn't take anything away from us. So, and if all beings acted from or experienced true peace of mind, they wouldn't act unskillfully. So, repeating the following thoughts, may all beings be free of stress and suffering and fear. May all beings be peaceful. May I be free of stress and suffering and fear. May I be peaceful. May all beings in all directions be calm and safe and be free of suffering. All beings north, south, east, west, above and below, in all directions, may all beings find true inner peace. And just take a moment to reside in whatever feelings arise from these thoughts. Thank you so much for coming to Dharma Punks.